So welcome, I'm David Kramer. Welcome on behalf of the Library of JTS. It's really our pleasure it's our pleasure to host all the book talks, but this one has a special status because, it's always nice when there are, connections, relations of different sorts. Please make sure that your phone is put on Do Not Disturb or its equivalent so that we're not interrupted in the middle. Let me just say a word about our book talk series and then about, this evening's book talk. Some of you have been coming over the course of the year. We've had a very, very exciting schedule of books. Our choice of books is directed by some very simple criteria. First of all, if our faculty members publish books, then we're happy to do book talks for them. But beyond that, we're looking for books that have, in our judgment, some significance. Jews who are interested in books, and Jews ought to be interested in books, and others should be interested in Jewish books as well. There are no boundaries here. They have something important to open our eyes to contribute, to offer us a different perspective, a different way of thinking. We've done fiction over the course of the year as well as nonfiction. I think this is probably our first memoir of the year, although I do have to say we have another book talk next week, which is another memoir. So I'll say some more about that afterward. Tonight is a special occasion for me for the very simple reason that I am a Talmudist, professor of Talmud here for years before I became director of the library. And being trained as an academic Talmudist, one has a very particular relationship to the text one studies. And one of the open questions is, how does this relate to your everyday life, to your personal life? That's not the way we're trained to think about the text that we study for purposes of our classes. And we may make those connections with our students on occasion, but the honest truth is that some of us are better at it than others. And even when we speak personally, I'll speak, now myself personally here, it's often in a way to try to help our students find the connections to their lives. And I've often puzzled over the question, how would the Talmud that I study relate in intimate ways to my everyday life? That has been, throughout my entire career, a difficult question for me to answer, I confess. And it was only when I turned to this book and opened up and saw how you address precisely that question. What is the relationship between this rich and abundant and generous text, but a text that in its richness, in its generosity, is actually very difficult to get under the surface of. It's rich and abundant, generous, only if somebody helps you open the door, if someone provides you with a key. And what this book does is to help to provide that key and to provide a connection, a model for how a text that too many of us view as obscure, as ancient, or as only related to the concerns of the Orthodox or ultra-Orthodox world, and not much beyond that, it turns out that this very, very generous text has a lot to offer to all of us. But we may not find the easy way in, and one of the things that this book does, and I'm eager to hear you speak about it yourself, is to say, this is my personal life, and this is this very rich text, and I found a way to put them together, and it will be a model for all of us. So, Ilana Kershon.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Kramer, and thanks to all of you for being here. I want to start with a story that took place just a few months ago after my book was published. My daughter, who was then about 18 months, woke up in the morning screaming and writhing in pain. She refused all food, and when I checked her mouth, I noticed cold sores all over her tongue, and her gums bled the moment I touched them. When I took her to the doctor, he diagnosed her with a virus and told me that sadly there was nothing to be done. You really just have to wait it out, he told me. She should be better in 7 to 10 days. My jaw dropped. 7 to 10 days of watching my daughter endure this agony? Is there really nothing I can do? I asked him desperately. Well, he told me, there is one proven remedy. You can put fresh goat's milk on her tongue. That works like a charm. I looked at him like he was crazy. Goat's milk? Can I get that at the supermarket? You can, said the doctor, but it won't work. You need the unpasteurized kind, and that's illegal to sell. You can only get it from a farm. It's best if they milk the goat for you, and then she drinks it right away. I couldn't believe that squeezing the udders of a goat was the only hope for my daughter, and so I tried the pharmacy, where, sure enough, I was told the exact same thing. On the one hand, my heart was sinking. Was there no other way to help my child? On the other hand, my mind was racing. I was finally beginning to understand a Talmudic story that had long baffled me. The story appears in the context of a Mishnah in Bava Kamma about the prohibition on raising small animals in the land of Israel, Ein Megadlin Behema Daka Be'eretz Yisrael. The Mishnah is referring to goats and sheep, since these animals are prone to pasture everywhere and destroy the surrounding vegetation. The Talmud then relates a story about the pious sage Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, who was groaning from his heart, gonach milibo, that is, moaning in severe pain. His friends asked the doctors what to do, and the doctors responded, the only remedy is for him to drink warm milk straight from a goat every morning at dawn. So they brought him a goat and tied it around his bedpost, and he would suckle from it every morning. One day, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava's rabbinic colleagues came to visit him. When they saw that he had a goat tied around his bedpost, they recoiled in horror. How could such a pious sage so brazenly override a rabbinic prohibition? When he eventually died, the sages reviewed all his actions, and the Talmud tells us they discovered that this was, in fact, the only sin he had committed. When I first encountered this story a few years ago, I wondered what illness this man could possibly have had such that goat's milk was the only remedy. I wondered what we'd call that illness today and how it would be treated in the 21st century. Clearly, it was the same illness as the father in Agnon's famous fable of the goat, which begins with the same words as our Talmudic story, Ma'aseh b'zaken echad shehaya gonech milibo ba'u v'sha'alu la'rofim. There's a tale of an old man who was groaning from his heart. They went and asked the doctors what to do. This man, too, ties a goat around his bedpost and suckles its milk, which is sweeter than honey from the Garden of Eden, says Agnon. Ultimately, his curiosity about the goat leads to his tragic separation from his son, who ties a rope to the goat's tail and follows the animal through a cave that leads, like C.S. Eliot's wardrobe or J.K. Rowling's platform 9 3/4, to a place near Tzfat. What illness did Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava and the father in Agnon's story have, I wondered? Now I knew. They had the same cold sores as my daughter, and the remedy in the 21st century is the same as it was back then. After several days of attempting to forcibly squirt pasteurized goat's milk from the supermarket onto my daughter's tongue to no avail, I decided I needed to take more drastic measures. I went around to a few natural health stores in my area, but none sold the illegal unpasteurized goat's milk, not surprisingly. Then a friend mentioned to me that there was going to be an agricultural festival at Hansen's Hospital, our local leprosy hospital. If you've ever lived in Jerusalem, you know what I'm referring to. She suspected that they would be selling fresh goat's milk, so I ran over there with my still hysterical baby the next morning. But alas, they told me the festival was postponed until the following week. Why don't you try the school down the block where they have a little petting zoo, someone at the festival suggested to me. So I put my baby back in the stroller and off we went on our wild goat chase. By this point, I felt very much like the son in Agnon's fable, was just holding on to the rope attached to the goat's tail and letting it carry me along for the ride. We arrived at the school. I spotted the goats in the yard. Can you help? I asked the guard at the gate. You have to ask Shlomo, he told me. He just stepped out for a few hours. My face fell. The baby howled, and the man looked at us in pity. Hold on, let me call Chezi. Chezi appeared with a twinkle in his eye. Who told you we have goats here? Perhaps he didn't want to let me in on his secret that he was raising small animals in the land of Israel. They told me at the leprosy hospital, I confessed. Follow me, he said, and I parked the stroller, picked up my baby, and continued to follow the proverbial rope attached to the proverbial goat's tail. He called over his friend, who held on to the head of the goat. Do you have a bottle, he asked me. I emptied the water from the baby's sippy cup, and he held it under the goat's udder. My daughter, who loves animals, had forgotten her groaning heart and began squealing in delight and shrieking, cat, cat, her term for anything with four legs that moves. I thanked Chezi profusely, retrieved my stroller, and gave the baby her cup. She drank, she calmed down, she fell asleep, and just a few hours later, she was back to herself. And I, though I wish my daughter had been spared the pain and discomfort, finally understood that story in Bava Kamma. Now, I share this anecdote because it's a somewhat recent example of how the Talmud page I study each day has informed so much of my daily experience and how my daily experiences have deepened my understanding of the text. When I first started learning Daf Yomi about a decade ago, it was not because I imagined that the Talmud would speak to me so personally, and not even because I had any particular interest in studying Talmud. It was more of a coping mechanism than anything else. At the time, I was going through a rough period. I was getting divorced after a brief marriage. I was living alone in Jerusalem, thousands of miles from my family and closest friends. And I was depressed. Time seemed to stretch ahead of me inexorably, and I was convinced that with every passing day, I was just going to get one day older. The only thing that got me out of bed in the mornings was that I had a friend I used to go jogging with, and one day my friend mentioned to me that she'd begun learning Daf Yomi, and she suggested that I try it too. I looked at her like she was crazy. I had heard of Daf Yomi. I knew that it was an international program to learn the entire Babylonian Talmud in 7.5 years at the rate of one page a day. But I couldn't understand why my friend, who was not particularly religious, was interested in studying all that Talmud. Not to mention that 7.5 years? My marriage had just fallen apart. I was in no position to make long-term commitments. I wouldn't even sign a rental agreement for more than 6 months. Not to mention that I couldn't imagine studying all that Talmud. I had studied some Talmud before. I went to a Salman Schechter school through the 8th grade. I thought of the Talmud as a dry legal code with a complicated and convoluted logic. I was put off by what I perceived to be the misogyny of the Talmud. Most of the women mentioned in the Talmud are either some rabbi's wife or daughter. Very few have independent identities. And then there's the sheer massiveness of the text. The Talmud consists of some 2,700 pages divided into 37 volumes known as Masechtot, tractates. Each of those Masechtot consists of several chapters. And as I'm thinking about all this, my friend stopped me and said something I never forgot. She said, Ilana, you're feeling completely stuck right now. Don't you think that maybe if every day you learned one page of Talmud, eventually a new chapter would have to begin? And I thought about that. I thought about how if every day I learned one page of Talmud, then with every passing day I would not just be one day older, I'd be one day wiser. This is, in fact, the Jewish view of time. The rabbis teach in Pirkei Avot, Ben Chamesh Lamikra, Ben Eser Lamishnah, Ben Chamesh Esrei LaTalmud. 5 is the age to begin studying Bible, 10 for Mishnah, 15 for studying Talmud. At that point, I was nearly almost twice age 15, but as we learn elsewhere in Pirkei Avot, if not now, when? And so I decided that I would begin Daf Yomi and see if perhaps a commitment to learning a page of Talmud a day might pull me forwards like a treadmill. What I discovered about the Talmud surprised me. Unlike later works that followed from it, the Talmud is not a law code that tells Jews how to behave, but rather a record of rabbinic conversations in which many of the questions are left open and unresolved. The Talmud is not a book for those who are searching for answers. It's really a book for those who are living the questions, as I was at that very uncertain time in my life. And unlike the Talmud I had studied in my Jewish day school, where we were always handed quoted passages cut and pasted onto source sheets, a crime I confess I am guilty of, Studying Talmud in context, page after page, was a completely different experience. I was working at the time as an editor. I was preoccupied by questions of structure and literary coherence, and I was fascinated by how the stream of rabbinic consciousness unfolds, proceeding by association rather than by any rational scheme. And so I followed along as the text meandered from a discussion about how cheese is curdled, to why Torah scholars resemble fragrant perfume, to a town that had a scarcity of bakers. And I choose that example because it's in a recent daf I just learned in Masechet Avodah Zarah, which is the current Daf Yomi Masechet. Sure, there were topics I found less interesting than others, but there was something that caught my eye on nearly every page, a folk remedy employed to heal an ailing sage, a rude insult leveled at one rabbi by another, or a sudden interjection from a rabbi's angry wife. I found myself carried along for the ride, listening in on the discussions among the rabbis, and tossed about like a rough wave when their arguments became particularly stormy. Early in my learning, I came upon a story about an encounter between a wise sage, Rabbi Yehoshua ben Hananya, and the daughter of the Roman emperor. Rabbi Yehoshua was a great Torah scholar, but we are told he was also a very ugly man, and the daughter of the Roman emperor took one look at him and said, "Chochmah mefoara b'chali mechoar, how can such beautiful wisdom be contained in so ugly a vessel?" Rabbi Yehoshua, the ugly vessel for beautiful Torah, came back at her with a question of his own. He said, "Does your father store his wine in clay vessels?" "Of course," she said, "doesn't everyone?" "But he's the emperor," said Rabbi Yehoshua. "Shouldn't he store his wine in the finest gold vessels?" She acknowledged that he had a point, and she transferred all her father's wine to gold vessels, where immediately it spoiled. Now, those of us who learned Daf Yomi are particularly poised to appreciate this story, having just finished the second chapter of Avodah Zarah, in which the Mishnah addresses Nodot HaGoyim V'Kankanehem, may a Jew store wine in the leather bottles and clay vessels previously used to store the wine of non-Jews. The rabbis consider the extent to which the walls of the vessels absorb the taste and properties of the wine previously stored in it. We learn in this chapter that clay vessels were so absorbent that the Romans would pour their wine into such jugs and then break the vessels into fragments, which they would carry with them wherever they went, so that whenever they wanted wine, they could simply soak the fragments in water and drink the wine that leached out. Sort of like ancient Kool-Aid mix. As the second chapter of Masechet Avodah Zarah teaches us, it is not just the container that may spoil or preserve the wine inside also changes the chemical composition of the vessel in which it is stored. This story speaks to the relationship between who we are and what we learn. All of us are vessels for the Torah we study, and the Torah we study fills us and assumes our shape, just as wine and all liquids take the shape of their container. And there is a chemical reaction that takes place between who we are and what we learn. We are transformed by the Torah we study, and the Torah we study is transformed by our encounter with it. It soon became clear to me just how much I was being transformed by my study. When I began learning, it was a very solitary pursuit. I would listen to podcasts I downloaded off the internet about the daily page of Talmud, following along in a volume of Talmud I'd borrowed from a neighbor alone in my apartment. The rabbis teach in Masechet Eruvin, "Hamahalech baderech ve'enimo levaya yasok batorah," that if one is walking along his way and has no companion, he should occupy himself with Torah. And so that's what I did. Daf Yomi was my companion during what was otherwise a rather lonely stretch of life. But as I soon realized, Daf Yomi is never really a solitary pursuit because tens of thousands of people learn Daf Yomi worldwide, and they're all literally on the same page. Following a schedule fixed in 1923 in Poland by Rabbi Meir Shapira, the founder of Daf Yomi. So I had essentially joined the world's largest book club. And even when I was studying alone at home, I was essentially inhabiting an enormous virtual classroom in which, sitting ahead of me, were rows and rows of scholars who'd studied that text in generations before me. And further along in the row I was sitting in were other students of Talmud elsewhere in Jerusalem, in Bnei Brak, in London, in Manhattan, in Muncie, and everywhere in the world there are people of the book. When I realized this, that I was inhabiting this virtual classroom, I was inspired to join a real Daf Yomi class that met in a local shul. I was the only woman in the class, and I brought down the average age by about 30 years. I was also the only one who took notes. I scribbled fast and furiously in the margins of my volumes of Talmud, noting lines I wanted to remember, jotting down explanations offered by the rabbi teaching the class, summarizing the various arguments under discussion. The men in the class would tease me that I should write in pen because pencil would fade, but someday someone would want to publish my notebooks. Neither they nor I had any idea how close that was to the truth. I began attending that class just at the beginning of Seder Nashim, the order of the Talmud that deals with women, and particularly with marriage, procreation, divorce, and wayward adulterous wives, among other topics. Sometimes it was awkward, not just because I was a woman, but because I was unmarried, and the Talmud looks pitifully upon any woman who does not have a man with whom to share her life, and especially her bed. They insist that a woman would rather be married than unmarried, even if her husband is the size of an ant. So they say, and they enter into elaborate discussions of women who have no wombs and women whose wombs are dormant because they have not had children for 10 years. I remember how conspicuous I felt with the only womb in the room. Whenever possible, I would peek ahead to the next page of Talmud to see if I'd feel comfortable attending class the next morning. Over the course of Seder Nashim, the rabbi shares several stories about difficult wives. Rav's wife would aggravate him by preparing lentils whenever he wanted peas. Rabbi Yossi Haglili's wife drove him so crazy that he borrowed money from a colleague so that he would be able to afford to divorce her. Rabbi Chia's wife tricked him so that she wouldn't have to bear him any more children. Rabbi Tzadok's marriage couldn't have been all that good because he was nearly seduced by a Roman matron. I found it hard to identify with any of the women mentioned in these Talmudic stories, even if they weren't as unpleasant as their husbands made them out to be. They seemed to spend most of their time sorting lentils or birthing children or gossiping with other women by the moonlight, none of which were activities that interested me at the time. Instead, as someone who was then unmarried and had no children, I found myself identifying with Ben Azai, the sage who was lambasted for his hypocrisy because he was a vocal champion of the importance of the mitzvah of procreation, though he himself had no children. What can I do? Ben Azai protested falteringly when the sages objected. Chashka nafshi b'Torah yitkayem olam al yedei achirim. My soul desires Torah. Let the world be sustained by others. At the time, I was in the habit of going to a different shir nearly every night after work. My friends would encourage me to come to singles events with them, to go to parties, to go out and have fun. What can I do? I would protest falteringly, quoting Ben Azai, my soul desires Torah. Eventually, I did meet my husband, not at a party or a singles event, but at a Parsha Shir. By that point, we had finished Seder Nashim and were already into Nezikin. In the middle of Bava Metzia, I convinced him to begin learning Daf Yomi with me, and he too has been learning ever since. We got married in the middle of Bava Batra, and by the time we had finished the cycle, we had 3 children, now 4. Our relationship has always been very different from that of most of the couples described in the Talmud. Yes, I annoy him sometimes, but I'm not the one who cooks for him while he goes to the Beit Midrash to study Torah. Certainly in the early years of our marriage, he did most of the cooking and cleaning, and I would keep him company by reading aloud from that day's page of Talmud. We would joke that we could get through half a daf in the time it took to fold a load of laundry, and that was really how we came to mark time in pages learned. After our kids were born, we would come to the end of our learning, not at the bottom of the page, but whenever the baby woke up. The pages from those months are filled with sudden slash marks to mark the points where we were interrupted. And then we'd pick up later in bed, falling asleep with the rabbi still arguing in our heads about how late one can recite the evening Shema. And so I followed the Talmud, but the Talmud also followed me through the various twists and turns my life took through divorce, aliyah, dating, marriage, pregnancy, and motherhood, all of which unfolded against the backdrop of my daily Talmud study. T.S. Eliot famously wrote in the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, "I have measured out my life in coffee spoons. I have measured out my life in Talmudic Masechtot. I remember various experiences in my 20s and 30s based on what I was learning in Daf Yomi at the time, and I associate Talmudic passages with what was going on in my life when I learned them. 5 years ago, I gave birth to twin girls. They were born right at the beginning of Masechet Shabbat. I remember that because soon after I returned home from the hospital, I came to the famous story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who lived during a time of Roman persecution when it was forbidden to study Torah. Rabbi Shimon flees with his son to the Beit Midrash, where they study Torah in secret. Only Rabbi Shimon's wife knows where they are. But soon Rabbi Shimon begins to worry that maybe his wife will betray them. After all, as he tells his son, Nashim de'atan kala alehen, women are lightheaded and easily swayed. So instead he takes his son and they flee to a cave where for 12 years they study Torah together. There are several strange and puzzling elements to this story. When Rabbi Shimon and his son are in the cave, they shed all their clothes and sit there buried up to their necks in sand like talking heads. A miracle occurs. God creates a carob tree and a spring of water that supply all their nutritional needs. And when at the end of 12 years they emerge from the cave, the light of the outside world is bright and blinding. They see people running to and fro, going about their daily business, and they wonder, what could these people possibly be rushing to? Ultimately, they return to the cave for another year of study, and Rabbi Shimon says to his son, "The world is enough with me and with you." I first came upon this story early in my maternity leave when I was holed up at home with my newborn twins. It was the dead of winter, so I rarely left the house, nor did I bother to get dressed in the morning. I just wore the same sweatpants day after day. I was essentially buried up to my neck in sand. My life consisted of an endless cycle of breastfeeding, diaper changing, and of course trying to keep up with my daily Talmud study. I was the carob tree and the spring of water, and the study partner all rolled up into one. On those rare occasions when I did manage to leave the house, bundling up my girls and packing them into the double stroller, I too felt like the harsh light of day was bewildering and blinding. I would see people running to catch a bus or get to work on time, and I would think to myself, where are they rushing to? What could possibly be so important? And then I would come back home and unbundle the girls, and I would look at them and sigh in weary elation and speak to them the same words that Rabbi Shimon spoke to his son, "The world is enough with me and with you." Now I know this story is often dismissed as an instance of rabbinic misogyny. After all, the whole reason Rabbi Shimon and his son flee to the cave is because Rabbi Shimon worries that his wife may betray him because women are lightheaded and easily swayed. This becomes even more pronounced when we consider the story in its halachic context in the second chapter of Masechet Shabbat, Bameh Madlikin, sandwiched between the Mishnah about the three sins for which women are punished in childbirth and the Mishnah about what a husband must remind his wife to do in her Shabbat preparations, as if this entire section of Talmud is overshadowed by a fear of women's sinfulness and flightiness. But when I read this story, I don't identify with Rabbi Shimon's lightheaded wife. I identify with Rabbi Shimon, engaged in an act of intimate Torah study with his son. For me, this story is above all a powerful articulation of maternal bonding, that stage in which a mother is as close to her child as when that child was still a part of her. The more I learn, the more it becomes clear to me that by the Talmud standards, I am a man and not a woman. If man is defined as an independent, self-sufficient adult, whereas woman is a dependent, generally living in either her father's or her husband's home. In some ways, this is a relief, because I can regard the Talmud's gender stereotypes as historical curiosities rather than infuriating provocations. The Talmud does not offend me because I'm defying its classifications through my very engagement with the text. So many of the classical interpretations of the Talmud reflect gendered assumptions, and these texts have the potential to take on radically new meaning when regarded through feminine eyes. Take the cave of Bar Yochai, traditionally regarded as a sort of kolel in the cave, where Bar Yochai and his son hide away and immerse themselves wholly in their learning, devoid of worldly concerns. Bar Yochai privileges the devotional over the political. He studies as a way of retreating from the world and disdains what he calls chaye sha'ah, temporal life. But I use my learning about Bar Yochai's dark cave, and so much of my other learning too, to shed light on my experiences outside the Beit Midrash and in the world. For me, Bar Yochai's cave became a metaphor for maternity leave, for that ultimate closeness between mother and child, almost like a womb, and indeed the same Talmudic term, kever, is used for both burial, tomb, and womb. And according to the Talmud in Nida, the baby in the womb learns the entire Torah and then forgets it when slapped by the angel upon entering into the air of the world. But the story of Bar Yochai does not end with a father and son emerging from the cave, even though that's usually the end when the story is taught, and that's where I ended it when I discussed it in my book. But the Talmud goes on to relate that after Bar Yochai emerges from the cave for the second time, he sees a man hurrying with two bunches of myrtle branches to get ready for Shabbat. He begins to realize that there are many ways to live a meaningful religious life. There is the intensity of wholehearted devotion to study, but then there is also the fulfillment of religious commandments. Bar Yochai decides that he wants to do something good in the world. He wants to do some sort of tikkun. Let me go and fix something, he says. He decides to purify the city of Tiberias so that the priests who walk over the ground where dead bodies may be buried do not inadvertently contract impurity. This may seem like a strange form of tikkun olam, but Bar Yochai's fundamental concern is for the welfare of others, and so he essentially makes the shift from being a scholar isolated in a cave to being a social activist. He is a reminder for me of what it means for our learning not to remain isolated and sequestered away from the rest of our thinking and living, but to permeate every fiber of our being and to inform how we think and act on a daily basis. As I've studied Daf Yomi in recent years, against the backdrop of life with crying babies and then rowdy toddlers and now strong-willed preschoolers, I've discovered that Talmudic passages that have nothing to do with motherhood or parenting take on a whole new meaning. When one of my twin girls got her first teeth before her sister and began biting her sister again and again, leaving her sister with no recourse, I invoke the biblical concept of a shor mu'ad, an ox which is known to have gored at least three times, which the Talmudic rabbis used to refer to one of the four categories of damages. When my son lost his beloved stuffed elephant and we bought him a replacement one, only to discover that the original elephant had been located by his teacher and restored to his preschool cubby, I came to a new understanding of the concept of korban tzmura, whereby one animal designated for sacrificial purposes is replaced by another. And as I emptied the dishwasher early in the morning so that I could have breakfast ready for my kids before they woke, I thought about Trumat HaDeshen, the first ritual performed in the temple every morning, which involved clearing away the ashes from the previous day's sacrifice, an act which, like emptying the dishwasher in the early morning, links the previous day with the day that is dawning. I imagine the activities I perform every day for my children as my korban tamid, the daily sacrifice offered every day in the temple. And I have gleaned lessons from my study of Talmud about how to be a better parent. I have known for a while that I am a much better parent in public. When I am home alone with my children, I am quick to anger and slow to forgive. When my son spills his water for the second time during dinner, I grow exasperated and yell at him instead of helping him find a better place for his cup. But when we're in the playground playing around with other children and their parents and my kids spray water from the fountain on each other, I merely exchange eye-rolling glances with the other parents and let the kids work it out. Somehow the knowledge that I am being watched enables me to hold myself in check, to restrain my frustration and anger, and to judge my kids favorably. It was around the time that I was becoming increasingly conscious of how much easier it is to parent well in public that I came to the famous story in Masechet Brachot about Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who fell ill and was visited by his disciples. When he saw them, he began to weep. His disciples asked him why he was weeping, and he responded that he did not know whether he was being led to heaven or to hell. His students, realizing that he was close to death, asked him for a blessing. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai responded, Yehi ratzon shetehei morah shamayim kimorah basar vadam. May it be God's will that your fear of heaven be like your fear of mortals. His disciples were taken aback. Ad kan, is that all? They asked. He responded, if only it were so. Know that whenever a person transgresses, he says, may no man see me. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai knew that it is often much easier to act properly in public. When we do something wrong, we are much more likely to hope that no one else witnessed our act than to worry about what God observed. But as the Talmud teaches in Masechet Chagiga, Kol ha'over avera b'seter ki'ilu dochek raglei hashchina. Anyone who commits a sin in secret, it is as if he is bumping against the legs of the divine presence. And they quote a pasuk from Isaiah, Hashamayim kisi v'haaretz hadom raglai. The heavens are my throne and the earth is my footstool. The rabbis imagine God sitting on a divine throne up in heaven with legs dangling down to earth. Anytime we sin when we are alone, we are in fact bumping up against God's feet. These sources remind me that while it is all too easy to sin while alone, it is in fact while we are by ourselves, with no one else around, that we have the greatest potential for intimacy with God. I think about what the Talmudic sages might say about helicopter parenting, which has become such a popular catchphrase of late. I suspect they would find it more instructive to speak not of parents who hover, but of those who hover over us as parents. I'll admit that it's hard to imagine the legs of the divine presence dangling in my living room, but I do find it helpful to imagine that a friend or neighbor has stopped by and is sitting beside me as I feed my kids dinner or read them bedtime stories. And so I'll sit there reading Goodnight Moon, following along as my daughter points to the pictures, but all the while I'm thinking of the little old lady who sits there watching. Just when I'm about to lose my temper, she rocks back and forth and whispers, hush. Now, this is a very personal example, and my book, too, touches upon personal matters, but I think that engaging deeply with Torah demands of us this personal connection. The Talmudic sage Rabbi Yossi says in Masechet Sotah, Ein divrei Torah mitkaimin ela b'mi shema'amid atzmo arom aleihem. Words of Torah can only be fully learned by one who makes himself naked before them. Rabbi Yossi is commonly understood as suggesting that in order to learn Torah deeply and fully, you need to strip yourself of any preconceived notions and start anew. But I read it differently. To me, it seems that the most meaningful way to study Torah is by searching for the interconnections and resonances between Torah and the rest of one's reading, learning, and living. Torah cannot be studied in a vacuum. So I prefer to interpret Rabbi Yossi's statement as implying that to learn Torah, you have to be willing to make yourself vulnerable. You have to summon the courage to let the text resonate in the darkest recesses of your soul, in the hope that the text will illuminate your soul, and your soul, in turn, will illuminate the text. I have bared much of my soul in my book, but I hope that doing so will inspire you to read your lives into the text of our tradition and to incorporate these texts into your lives. And yet I never set out to write a personal book. I wrote the material that became this book initially for myself as my ongoing commentary on the Talmud as I was learning. I filled the margins of my volumes of Talmud with my notes, and when I had more to say than could fit in the margins, I began writing journal entries and blog posts. I never dreamed that this material would be published, and so I suppose that in the earlier drafts, I was more open and more bold. 5 years ago, on my maternity leave, I began thinking about collecting all this material to prepare for completing my first cycle of Daf Yomi. By that point, the notes I had taken and the essays I'd written had already become so much a part of how I understood the Talmudic texts that I could not possibly omit them from my discussion. The events of my personal life served to illuminate the text, to make an argument for a way of reading the text, in which the text is a commentary on life, and life is a commentary on the text. even though to my mind it is clear that the personal dimension of the book is essentially a hermeneutical technique. I was very nervous about sharing this book with the world. I think of myself as a private person. The rabbis of the Talmud speak of the notion of hezek re'iyah, the idea that being seen can constitute a form of damage. For me, this notion has always felt very real. I grew up as a rabbi's daughter, and we were taught the value of privacy from a young age. We were always supposed to say when the phone rang that Abba can't come to the phone right now, and not Abba's at the supermarket, or Abba's at the cemetery, or Abba's at a wedding that you weren't invited to. I internalized the value of privacy from an early age, and perhaps that's part of the reason there's a lot I omitted from my book. There's a lot I left on the cutting room floor. I suppose that's something I have in common with the editors of the Talmud. They were always picking and choosing what they would draw from other sources, what they would quote. The rabbis will quote one braita, but not another. The very concept of a braita is something outside, something excluded, something that did not make it into the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasih. Those statements that did not make it into the Mishnah were published as the Tosefta. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I hope no one ever publishes my Tosefta. The Mishnah and Tosefta, as well as the Talmud, were originally oral texts memorized by scholars who were essentially walking books and who would recite them on demand. We have lost much of that sense of orality in our world of print and screens, and yet it's clear to me that there's a certain degree of mastery that comes only when you know a text by heart. And so I've come up with my own mnemonic devices for remembering what I have learned. I try to write a limerick or a sonnet for every page of Talmud I study. These poems, which are catchy and easy to remember, enable me to summon, even years later, those passages I'd particularly enjoyed. They also serve as a way of reviewing my learning, since I write them after I've completed a perek or a long sugya. So I thought I'd read one. Well, I'll just read one as an example. All right, this is from Bava Metzia. It's about how you're not supposed to remind someone who's either converted or returned to Judaism about any sins he may have committed before this recommitted life. So, if a convert comes by, you can't say it was 10 years ago to the day that your dad ate some pork with a spoon and a fork. Do not torture or turn him away. Anyway, I have hundreds of these, but I'm not going to read more. Now, these poems speak to how I read Talmud as a literary text. As someone who reads much poetry, I could not help but hear echoes of poems I loved in the Talmud. Talmudic stories are written in concise literary units in which no detail is extraneous and meaning is rarely transparent, which is how I think of poetry. And so perhaps it's not surprising that I heard Shakespeare's Double Double Toil and Trouble in the rabbinic discussion of how to cure leprosy by boiling a pot filled with the rind of a nut tree, the shavings of a dressed hide, and sweet-scented clover. And I heard Emily Dickinson's Because I Could Not Stop for Death in the rabbinic discussion of the sage who kept learning Torah so that the angel of death would not be able to snatch his soul. And I heard Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn in the rabbinic discussion of the relationship between beauty and transience. Given that I heard so much poetry in the Talmud, it did not seem like too much of a stretch to begin writing poetry about the Talmud I was learning. My Talmud poetry is essentially my attempt to rewrite Torah for myself, which is a rabbinic dictum in Masechet Sanhedrin. The rabbis teach, Afal pi shehinichu lo avotav le'adam sefer Torah mitzvah lichtov mishelo. Even though one's ancestors have left him a scroll of the Torah, it's a mitzvah to write one for oneself. I would love to unpack this source at length, but maybe another time, because it's great. But anyway, I identify very much with the statement, so much so that I used it as the epigraph to my book. I think that to truly learn Torah is to write it for yourself, to rewrite it for yourself, which is how I regard my project in this memoir. In this sense, I suppose I'm following in the footsteps of the daughters of Tzlofchad, who, the Torah teaches, approached Moshe when Bnei Israel were in the wilderness to ask if they too might inherit a plot of land in Israel, since their father had died, leaving no sons to inherit him. God instructed Moshe that yes, Tzlofchad's five daughters should inherit their father's portion and have their own share in the land. The Midrash in Sifrei Bamidbar explains why God granted them this dispensation. I will read the Midrash because it's short. Vatikravna b'not Tzlofchad, kevan sheshamu b'not Tzlofchad she'aretz mitchaleket l'shvatim, l'zcharim v'lo l'nekevot, nidkabtsu zo al zo litol etza. Amru, lo krachamei basar vadam rachamei hamakom. Basar vadam rachamav al hascharim yoter min hanekevot. Aval Misha Amar Vehayaha Ulam Enokain Ela Rachamav Al Hascharim Ve Al Hanekevot Rachamav Al Hakol Shene Amar Tov Hashem Lakol Verachamav Al Kol Maasav. Human beings are not always equally compassionate to men and women, but God, who spoke the world into being and created both man and woman, is compassionate to all. And so, Benot Tzlofchad found their place in the land of Israel. The Talmud in Sanhedrin comments that the daughters of Tzlofchad did not just merit to inherit land, they also merited to write the entire portion of the Torah that deals with the division of land in Israel. That is to say, women contributed to the writing of Torah, and thus women have been writing Torah for even longer than men have been studying it. I am excited to be among them and to regard the Talmud, though plowed through by generations of scholars, as fertile ground for gleaning new insights. It is an awareness of the manifold interpretive possibilities and creative ways of engaging with the Talmud that inspired the title of my book, If All the Seas Were Ink. The title is a reference to a trope that appears throughout rabbinic literature. I first encountered it in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which I learned with a friend in a cafe in Jerusalem known as Aroma, though we call it Cafe Amora, because we sit there every Tuesday afternoon and learn Amoraic Midrash. The Midrash quotes Rabbi Eliezer, who says that if all the seas were ink and all the reeds pens and all the heaven and earth scrolls and all of mankind scribes, they would not suffice to write all the Torah that I have learned, and yet I have diminished no more from it than a man would take by dipping a small vial into a vast ocean. Rabbi Akiva, his student, puts it a bit differently. His learning from his teacher has been like someone who smells the fragrant scent of an etrog. The etrog is not diminished at all because of what he has smelled. Rabbi Akiva also compares the study of Torah to lighting one lamp from another. The first lamp does not lose any of its brightness when it kindles the second. These sources capture the infinite nature of Torah study. Torah is as vast as the sea, and each time we learn, we are taking in only as much as could fill a small vial dipped into a vast ocean. And yet Torah is infinite, so when we study Torah, we do not diminish Torah. We are rather increasing and replenishing the beauty and light in the world. When I think back to that all-male Daf Yomi class I used to sit in on 10 years ago, I realize that it has taken me a long time to learn this lesson. Though I attended that class for nearly 2 years, I almost never opened my mouth. I thought, everyone around me has been learning Talmud for decades. What could I possibly have to contribute to a conversation that has been unfolding for 2,000 years? I'm reminded of a story in Masechet Chagiga about that same Rabbi Yehoshua, the ugly rabbi, who once sent two of his disciples to go learn in another rabbi's academy. When those students came back, he asked them, "So, what did you learn? What can you teach me?" His students looked at him like he was crazy. "Talmidecha anu, umeimecha anu shotim," they said. "We are your students. We drink from your waters." Again, invoking that analogy between Torah and liquid, what could we possibly have to teach you that you don't already know? Rabbi Yehoshua looked at his students gravely and said to them, "Eifshar lebeit midrash lelo chidush." There can be no encounter with Torah that does not produce new Torah. Anytime you engage with a text of our tradition, you come up with new insights. You may think that because it's your first time reading a particular text or opening a volume of Talmud, that you can't possibly have anything original to share. But as someone who teaches, I can say that it is often those who view the text through fresh eyes who make the most valuable contributions. No two people read the text in exactly the same way, nor does any one person read the text the same way at two different points in his or her life. There is always something new to be discovered. And so, encouraged by their teacher, Rabbi Yehoshua's students shared that they had learned, "Afata aseh oznecha ke'afer keset." You must make your ears into a funnel to receive Torah. You must make yourself receptive to Torah so that Torah fills you, shapes you, and assumes your shape. When Rabbi Yehoshua heard this, he said to his students, "Margalit tova heita b'yadchem uvikashtem le'ovda mimeni." You had this precious pearl of wisdom and you sought to deprive me of it? Each of us has precious pearls of wisdom to share with others. Each of us can assume a seat that can be occupied by no one else in the communal enterprise of Talmud Torah. Each of us has a life that can enrich the text, and each of us has been given Morasha Kehilat Yaakov, a rich, vast, infinite textual heritage that can enrich our lives. May the world merit to be enriched by the words of Torah inside each and every one of us. Thank you.